Kia ora, tānau. I'm Joe Hollander, the Chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust and the Defence Advisory Heritage Group. And again, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to our midday monthly military history presentation. I was just saying to our speaker that we try and keep things as balanced as possible, and that it's not a whole lot of brown jobs swinging the lights and talking about their operations all around the world, that we try and include the other services as well, and so therefore, you know, Navy and Air Force do get a bite of the cherry, and at some stage we'll probably get the Merchant Navy involved too to try and keep a bit of a balance. This year we've been focusing on a lot of service activities, whereas next year we're going to start focusing more on commemorations and anniversaries. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So really, without too much further ado, our speaker today, I think, is well known to many of you, and it's great to have you back, David. He's been a regular contributor and speaker to these sessions, and it's really great to get the benefit of his knowledge and experience, and in particular, the topic today, talking about the Pukeahu War Memorial Park in Wellington, of which David is chair of the trust board. So without further ado, welcome David.
Thanks, Joe. So good afternoon. I'd just like to say at the outset I'm not a professional historian, but unfortunately I do have firm views on a lot of things, so that may come through in part of this talk. But I am quite interested in how we memorialise war and conflict. I haven't done a lot of reading on it, but I did read a Vietnamese author who said that wars are fought two times. First on the battlefield and second in the national memory. And so that's something that resonates with me. So today I'll talk about Pukeahu National War Memorial Park, and hopefully come up with some interesting stories based on my 10 years as chair of the National War Memorial Advisory Council. So I was appointed the chair in 2009. The council is formally established under the National War Memorial Act, and its principal function, in accordance with that act, is to advise the Minister of Arts, Culture and Heritage on all matters pertaining to the National War Memorial. Sounds grand, really, but in reality, you've got a government agency called the Ministry of Culture and Heritage who smack themselves right in the middle of the relationship. And so essentially, you're providing advice to them. I think the advice is important from one perspective, and that is, if we're going to be serious about memorialising conflict and wars and the people who get involved in them, there's an emotional dimension that's important. But people in government agencies see it essentially as a bureaucratic activity, and the emotional bit doesn't resonate. Membership of the council is a person that's appointed by the minister, two by the minister on recommendation of the RSA, one of those is normally the national president, a senior serving or retired officer of the Defence Force, on the recommendation of the Chief of Defence Force, and that was how I was appointed to the National War Memorial Advisory Council and the Chief Executive of the Ministry of Culture and Heritage. But generally, the Chief Executive of the Ministry of Culture and Heritage delegates their responsibilities on the council. And unsurprisingly, with the exception of the Ministry representative, the members are not paid for their contribution to the job. Now, when I joined the National War Memorial Advisory Council, there was a tradition that we actually did that job as part of our service. I think you could get a meal allowance or a daily rate, but it was like, this is our service. And so that was the tradition, that we didn't ask for any funding at all to participate on the council. And again, this is the This is that emotional bit, the commitment to those who have served and to honouring and acknowledging them. So Pukeahu National War Memorial Park commemorates more than 300,000 New Zealanders who served their country and 30,000 who died. It was the government's key project to acknowledge the centenary of the First World War, and despite some challenges, it opened in time for Anzac Day 2015. What's interesting here is these are not the slides I was going to do. So essentially, it straddles the old State Highway 1, so there's a National War Memorial to the north, the Australian War Memorial to the south, then it stretches out between Tory Street and Kalamaki Street. The National War Memorial is the centre and the Australian Memorial directly opposite. Now, originally, at the entrance, there was going to be a New Zealand Wars Memorial. I see that, I mean, people refer to the New Zealand Wars as the Land Wars, the New Zealand Wars, but again, this is something I have a strong view on. For Taranaki, it may have been about land, but for Waikato, it was about sovereignty. So New Zealand Wars, to me, is the appropriate thing. Now, the difficulty I had with the New Zealand Wars Memorial is, first of all, in 2015, the focus was on World War One. And my view was that focus should not be dispersed at all. The second thing is, I made the point that actually it's turned out that the National War Memorial honours and acknowledges those who have served overseas for their country. The New Zealand Wars are an internal matter. They're not an overseas conflict. And arguably, some people serve their country, some people serve their people. You can have that discussion for as long as you like. But the fact of the matter too is that the Australians were involved, so how do you acknowledge the Australian contribution to the New Zealand Wars? Furthermore, in my view, the New Zealand Wars, part of it, particularly Kupapa Māori, was their response was formed by the musket wars. So the musket wars are part of the New Zealand Wars story. And in my view, the most appropriate place for a New Zealand Wars memorial is in the grounds of Parliament buildings as a national statement about acknowledging our past beyond 1840. So anyway, the New Zealand Wars Memorial didn't happen. It was raised again as an issue, and again I wrote about my concerns about it was starting to diffuse the purpose of the park. And the other members of the Advisory Council agreed with me on that. So initial planning for the park included elements that were shaped by the social history focus of the historians involved. So initial planning meetings were, we're going to have a park to commemorate New Zealanders who have served overseas. And then there was a discussion about, well, in the park, we should have a memorial to the conscientious objectors. And then we should have a memorial to the people who went on strike. And then we should have a memorial to this. And again, it was, that is not the purpose of this park. It is not a park to acknowledge New Zealand's general history. It has a sole focus, and that should be allowed to be undisturbed. Right. The National War Memorial is located at the spiritual core of the park. So I'm quite keen on these terms like spiritual and emotional. And it's the spiritual core of the park. It has four elements, of which three, the Carillon, the Hall of Memories, and the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior, are, in my view, the most important. The fourth element, standing to the west of the tomb, is, to my mind, a disruption to the formal and elegant lines of the other three elements. It's the so-called man with the donkey. More on this later on. Let's see where I am. So, the National War Memorial. More than 18,000 New Zealand soldiers died in the First World War, and most were buried overseas. There was an immense, and this was an immense and traumatic loss, number of losses for a small country, and the families and friends of those who died had no graves at which to grieve their loved ones. In 1919, the government approved that £100,000 be set aside for the building of a national memorial in Wellington. It was to be built in a position where it would be visible from any part of the city and from ships entering the harbour. In his budget speech, Minister of Finance James Allan said, "We can and ought to do something to perpetuate the memory of the men and women who gave their lives for the benefit of those of us who remain to share in the blessings to be enjoyed from what we hope may prove to be a lasting peace." However, I am unconvinced there is absolute clarity about the fundamental purpose of the National War Memorial. And this touches on the question of whether with our war memorials, we are honouring only sacrifice to the exclusion of service, or are they honouring both? So I had a slide of two plaques in front of the National War Memorial. One talks about the National War Memorial commemorating sacrifice. The other talking about the National War Memorial commemorating service and sacrifice. The two. And I'll get on to this element later on in my speech, but I just say it's worth noting that about 140,000 men and women were dispatched overseas in the Second World War. Of these, just under 12,000 were killed. So the bulk of people served. And those who served also suffered. Many of them. The Carillon was finally opened 13 years later by Governor General Lord Bledisloe on Anzac Day, 25 April 1932, in front of more than 50,000 people. Although the Hall of Memories adjacent to the Carillon was part of the original design, it wasn't to be completed for another 32 years, opening in 1964. And on Armistice Day, 11th of November 2004, New Zealand's unknown warrior was interred in front of the Carillon after being brought home from France, where he had been killed in the First World War. That's the term of the unknown warrior. The Carillon. Today, the 74 bells of the Carillon, weighing over 70 tonnes, constitute a musical instrument which is actually played by a keyboard. The Carillon in the National War Memorial is the third largest such instrument in the world. Among the bells are those named after the grand philosophies that have shaped this country's path into its wars in foreign fields, sustained its commitment during them, and provided a light to guide its navigation through the delicate state of affairs we call peace. These bells include Roha, Grace, Tumanako, Hope, and Rangi Marie, Peace. However, those philosophical bells are outnumbered by the bells with names that mark the bloody battles of the First World War and the names of those killed in those battles. At the time of its dedication, the Carillon had only 49 bells. They were provided by private donations and are inscribed with the names of military services, units, and particular battles. Among them are the 33 bells with the names of individuals etched upon them, donated by the next of kin of men killed in the war. I'd like to talk about just five of these bells to provide a sense of the tragedy and despair of war. The first bell is named Suvla Bay. Suvla Bay, to the north of Anzac Cove, was a site of a British amphibious landing on the night of 6th August 1915. The landings were part of the so-called August Offensive, the final British attempt to break the deadlock of the Battle of Gallipoli. When it failed, activity at Suvla subsided into sporadic fighting until the British withdrew in late December. The inscription on this bell is, "In memory of Henry Barnard and Charles Valentine Barnard, given by their mother, Helena M. Barnard." Henry Barnard was 25 years old when he was killed on 12 August 1915. A press report at the time of his brother Charles' death in France, just over 2 years later, on 25 November 1917, read, "News has been received of the death in action of rifleman Charles V. Barnard, who was one of a family of fighting men. 6 of the 8 brothers composing the family have been on or are on active service, and the head of the family, Mr. H.J. Barnard, is employed in the Defence Department in Wellington. Of the brothers, 2 have been killed, 2 invalided at home, severely wounded, and 2 are still fighting. The late rifleman Barnard was just 21 years old at the time of his death." The second bell is not named. It does, however, have an inscription. "In memory of Watkin Eldridge Lewis, Tom Eldridge Lewis, and Samuel Eldridge Lewis, given by their sisters and brothers." Of the 3 brothers, Watkin was killed at Gallipoli on 8th August 1915. Tom died of wounds just 1 day after him at sea of Gallipoli. Their brother Samuel was killed during the Battle of Cullen Camps on the Somme on 5 April 1918. He was 35 years old. The third bell is named Heberturn. Heberturn is a farming village situated 15 miles southwest of the town of Arras and about 2 miles north of Collincump. For most of the First World War, it was in the front line of the Western Front. The inscription on this bell reads, "In memory of Raymond Shirley McCarty, Clarence Vivian McCarty, and Cyril James McCarty, given by their father, James McCarty." Raymond McCarty was killed in Belgium on 12 October 1917. Cyril was killed in France almost 3 years after leaving New Zealand on 22 May 1918. As to their brother, Corporal Clarence McCarty, his obituary reads, "In loving memory of Clarence Vivian McCarty, Clary, who was accidentally killed at Ashburton on the night of 27th February 1923 in his 29th year. Who would have thought who saw him that day? So light was his footstep, so bright was his eye, at eventide God took his beautiful flower. Ah, who would have thought how soon he must die? None knew him but to love him. None mentioned his name but to praise. Inserted by his father, Brother Lance, and Rhoda. Clarence McCarty was on his way to his wedding when he was killed." The fourth bell dispels any myth that all of those who died in the service of this country in the First World War were of what may be characterised as of British stock. It is inscribed with the name Prithia.
Okay. Yeah, just give us a couple of ticks. It got compromised, so we've got the full presentation, and I'm sure.
So I'm just going over these I know it can get a bit like overpowering, but just imagine the grief of these families who had stayed behind in New Zealand, and the brothers who had survived the war, and just the tragic stories attached to these bells. It's just horrific, and that's part of the memorialisation, is that war is awful. So as I said at the beginning, this is the park with the National War Memorial, the Australian Memorial. I'll talk about that later. The Arras Tunnel, this is Anzac Square. This is where the New Zealand Wars Memorial was proposed. This is the eastern flank, and there's the western flank down the bottom. I've just highlighted. I'll talk later on about the Australian Memorial, the British Memorial, and the Pacific Islands Memorial, which is the one on the extreme left of that slide. So that was the original vision of the National War Memorial, with this large boulevard running down to the sea. That was the grand plan. So this is the thing I was talking about before. You know, what is the point of it? So this one says, to the glory of God and memory of the New Zealanders who have died on active service in defence of their country, and to commemorate the opening of school, 1961. So it's quite explicit that it's about those who were killed. This one here, interesting to me, you know, that it has starts off with some Rāmaru, Rea Wairua. To the glory of God, to the memory of New Zealanders that died in the Great War, and in honour of those that served or suffered. So we've got two quite different positions adopted in these summits, and I tend to favour the 1931 one rather than the 1961 one. As I say, service or sacrifice or both. The opening of the Carillon, you've seen that, massive crowd. So these are the bells, just to give you. The guy in the photo, Timothy Hurd, in the green jacket, is a national carillonist. So just to give you a sense of the scale of the bells, and that's him playing the keyboard. So he pounds that to play the bells.
So jerky on the road.
And that's the Hall of Memories being constructed. So the Hall of Memories. We'll get on to that. I'll just go back. So I was saying that the bell that dispels the myth that it was only people of British stock who fought and died in the First World War. The bell is inscribed with the name Krithia. The village of Krithia, about 6 kilometres north of Cape Hellas at the southern tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula, sits at a point at which the peninsula is about 3.5 miles across. It was a key feature for the Allied forces to take if they were to capture the neighbouring hill and so be able to advance up the Gallipoli Peninsula to the forts that controlled passage of the Dardanelles Straits. Below the name Krithia is written, in memory of Ateo Frundi, given by his sister. Ateo Frundi was born in Italy in 1873. And before answering the call to arms, he was a piano tuner in Wellington. He was 41 years old and single when he was killed on 8 May 1915 during the Second Battle of Krithia. A newspaper at the time of his death reported, Captain Ateo Frundi, whose death in action at the front was announced yesterday, came of fighting stock. His father was a member of Garibaldi's army and fought in several battles, the last in 1866. Two of the Garibaldi sons are now fighting in the Dardanelles, and the youth is going to the front with reinforcements. The fifth bell is named Flanders Fields, and the inscription is, in ever-loving memory of Leslie Heron, only son of Harold and Annie Bunnell Bouchon. Leslie Heron Beauchamp was the son of Sir Harold Beauchamp and Lady Beauchamp, and the brother of Catherine Mansfield, who was killed in France on 6th October 1915 while giving instruction in the use of hand grenades. One exploded in his hand and killed him. He was 21 years old. Catherine Mansfield's life and work were changed by his death, and in a poem describing a dream she had shortly after he died, she wrote, "By the remembered stream my brother stands, waiting for me with berries in his hands. These are my body's sister, take and eat." These bells and their companions tell stories from a war fought far from our shores. In their tolling and their silence, they are reminiscent of the so-called war to end war that started with the patriotic tinkle of music but ended with the dark silence of people contemplating its bloody cost. The Hall of Memories. After the Carillon was built, construction of the Hall of Memories was put on hold because of the economic depression of the 1930s and then because of the Second World War. In 1955, the government set out to build a simple but dignified building as a memorial for New Zealand's war dead. This was seen as increasingly important to meet public expectations of memorialising the war following the Second World War and the Korean War. Following several construction setbacks, the hall was finally unveiled by Governor General Sir Bernard Ferguson and Prime Minister Keith Holyoake on 5 April 1964. That's it, under construction. The Hall of Memories. Given the dominant role of the Army in the two world wars and the substantial cost it paid in its fighting, it is understandable that as the bells are dominated by Army stories, so too does the Army's presence dominate the Hall of Memories. At the northern end, the entrance point is the Roll of Honour, contained in four books inside which are the names of the almost 30,000 New Zealanders killed in the country's overseas wars. Two books each in a cabinet either side of the entrance. Unlike in Australia, where they are relegated to the Roll of Remembrance, with its solely civilian names, New Zealand's Roll of Honour includes the names of merchant navy seafarers killed in the two world wars. Although it's very unlikely that the list of names for the merchant navy includes the names of all of those killed in the wars. Among the saddest names in the Roll of Honour, I think, are those of Lance Corporal Rory Malone, killed in Afghanistan in 2012, and Lieutenant Colonel William George Malone, his great-great-grandfather, who was killed at Gallipoli in 1915. So it's really extremely sad to see those two names in the Roll of Honour. Six recesses or mini chapels. That's recesses. Mini chapels, sorry. Along here. This is the Army War. Flank each side of the hall. Each has its own dedicated plaque of remembrance to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Merchant Navy. Six alcoves flank both sides of the Hall of Memories. All six on the eastern side acknowledge the Army. On the other side, there are two for the Navy. That's Royal Navy, because the Royal New Zealand Navy was formed on 1 October 1941. So there's a Royal Navy and then Royal New Zealand Navy. And three for the Air Force and one for the Merchant Navy. Four alcoves in the corners also contain mounted wall plaques commemorating the conflicts in South Africa, Korea, Malaya, and Vietnam. What I'm next going to say, to me, sort of symbolises the casual approach to memorialisation by bureaucracy. What is notable about this arrangement is that Malaya represents the Malayan emergency, which was from 1948 to 1960. When New Zealand became involved in confrontation, 1964 to 1966, the country was called Malaysia. So I take the position that the only one of the emergency and confrontation being acknowledged in the Hall of Memories is the emergency, and confrontation is not acknowledged. If it were, Malaysia would be there. Worthy of further note is that there is no visible record of New Zealand's military endeavours overseas post the Vietnam War, with the exception of the names and the role of honour. Now, Parliament actually has acknowledged post-Second World War II operations, but I have a problem with their approach, because they have a plaque which says Timor, one which says Afghanistan, and the other which says all the rest. So it's very clear that their marker for whether or not you get your own plaque was, were people killed, not did people serve. And I'm sure the people who served in Bosnia, for example, might have a different view on what their service was like compared to some of the others. They also have a memorial, a plaque to the New Zealand walls in the Houses of Parliament. So, but nothing in the Hall of Memories. And I raised it quite often in the Hall. On the eastern side, I'm just talking about, this panel here, which is here. On the eastern side is a three-panel Māori carving known as Tahi. This was presented by Gallipoli veterans in honour of the Māori Pioneer Battalion of the First World War. At the southern end of the sanctuary, at its central point, stands Lyndon Smith's statue, Mother and Children. A statue depicting a wartime family giving one another comfort and hope in the absence of loved ones overseas. When Hillary Clinton laid a wreath in the hall during a visit as the US Secretary of State, she remarked that it was the most surprising and poignant statue she had seen in a war memorial scene. As many war memorials will have, you know, the God of War or Warriors or something like that. And this is quite different and very sensitive. Now I get on to what I call the two flags stories. The one on the left. My story here is, it's an ongoing story I tell about the battle of the Merchant Navy for fair representation. Now, the photo on the left is still online. What happened is the Navy white ensign was getting a bit tattered and dirty. So we said to the Navy, could you replace your white ensign? And the Navy said, yes, we'll replace all three flags. So this is what they came up with. So the massive flag in the centre is a New Zealand white ensign. The pathetic stuff flag on the right is a New Zealand national flag. And the one on the left is the red ensign. The protocol is the flag in the middle is a national flag. Anyone should know that. And that should be dominant over the other two. But no, the Navy thought that was the way it should be. The story on the right. In these spaces, there can be sensitivities that you're not necessarily aware of. So we had the Irish prisoner of Ireland, visited the National War Memorial. And what they do is they set up a desk in the lobby, which is where this is, for the guest of honour to sign the visitor's book, photo taken. They put the desk in front of the Union Jack. And the Irish president saw it and said, can you move it to the other side? So in the background is a New Zealand flag.
Well, the butcher's apron.
Nothing much has changed.
Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. The Hall of Memory, might be, the Hall of Memories and the Carillon are starkly British and Christian in their approach to memorialisation, as is obviously evident in their design. And quite often during ceremonies in the National War Memorial, I had to say to the padre, this is not a church service. This is a ceremony. And so I was very, very clear to call it a ceremony, not a service. The religious part is an important part, but it shouldn't overwhelm the rest of the activity. I'll just make a point that the Pahutukawa trees that frame the approaches to the National War Memorial clearly make a statement, this is New Zealand. And the transition from a solely or markedly British approach to a more obviously New Zealand one can be seen in the design of the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. And the aspirations of its designer, who said, the tomb is an expression of the nation's memory and a cross-cultural language of remembrance that combines Māori and Pākehā ritual, symbolic and visual elements to express remembrance specific to New Zealand's contemporary identity. So, in my view, that things will change over time, but at the National War Memorial, when I first got involved, it was so religious and so staunchly British that I was determined to do what I could change it. So there used to be that after a ceremony, the VIPs would put on the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior roses. And my view was, well, that's a British approach. I want to change that. So now they put on the fern frond. Just to say there's a New Zealand dimension to the ceremony. And there's a karanga for the people coming up to the National War Memorial as well. On 11th November 2004, after service at St Paul's Anglican Cathedral, in a 2.85 kilometre slow march procession through the streets of Wellington, lined by about 100,000 people, the tomb was sealed, the body inside, and a bronze mantle at 3:59. Now, I participated in that march as the Chief of Navy. I'd make two comments. First of all, in my view, senior officers don't march, they stroll. That's their preference and their natural inclination. The second thing is, I got back to my office and my driver said, Christ, imagine the weight of those sailors carrying those rifles across their shoulders for that march. And I looked at her and said, what about the weight I had of the Navy on my bloody shoulders? What if I'd said I've had enough on the parade ground? Because I had done that once before. I was commanding officer of Waikato when we went to Penang for an important Malaysian Navy commemoration. And we were anchored off the port. We had to go ashore at dawn. We all had to line up on a public space. And then we were to march through the streets of Penang. Well, me and my ship's company were stuck behind an Indonesian Navy band. At every intersection, they performed for the crowd. So we'd march, reach an intersection, perform, start off again, another exit. And we were getting pretty annoyed. We turned the final corner, there was the strait, the VIP grandstand, my Chief of Navy there, everyone there, and this band did it again. And my response was, HMNZ Waikato, halt, dismiss. And we walked off the parade. I'd had enough. So, but the tomb now is an important element of the National War. Right, man with a donkey. This thing drives me crazy, I'm sorry. You can just see it here. And I know Right. The bronze sculpture, The Man with the Donkey, is a tribute to all medical personnel, stretcher bearers, and ambulance drivers who served alongside New Zealand troops in wartime. Commissioned by the RSA, with sponsorship from Oceanic Life, it was unveiled by Henderson's son, Ross, on 20 April 1990. It is an anomaly in the National War Memorial precinct, and in my view, should not be there. I found this Australian photo online. Look at the contrast between the two portrayals of the man on the donkey and the person alongside them. The one on the right is the New Zealand one. It looks like he's out for a walk. There's no... It's just appalling. And the difficulty is when you get a memorial to the medical corps, then the nurses say, we want a memorial. And then the Vietnam vets say, we want a memorial. And then the Korean vets say they want a memorial. So it goes on and on and on. And our line was, everyone is remembered in the National War Memorial. That is your memorial. And the Governor General got a letter from nurses, you know, wanting a memorial for nurses. And it came my way to draft a reply, which I did, saying, no, it's not going to happen. And he signed it, and we both got into trouble because I hadn't been through a single government agency or government minister. But it went on. So that's, you know, that's the problem. The Veterans Associations would love to have their memorials in the park, but that's not the purpose of the memorials in the park. The purpose of those memorials is to recognise New Zealand's relationship with specific countries. So that's The Man with the Donkey. Some of the memorials in the park, as I was mentioning, the memorials in the park are supposedly provided by and recognised countries with which New Zealand has a long and close connection, the military thread being just one part of that connection. Consequently, the memorials define New Zealand's place in the world and our national view of that place. In this context, what is striking to me, particularly given our military record, is there is not a single memorial from an Asian country in the park, and the Pacific Memorial sits in isolation on the park's eastern flank. Thinking about the memorials, I would occasionally reflect on how far the spirit of reconciliation will take us towards German and Japanese memorials of some kind. The German government did present a memorial tapestry to New Zealand in 2017. This is a photo of the tapestry. As part of his visit to the National War Memorial in November of that year, the German president unveiled the tapestry gifted to New Zealand on behalf of the people of Germany. The tapestry titled Flanders is part of a series based on photographs of 14 First World War battle sites. Artist Stefan Schenk, who was present at the unveiling, explained how the work was a reminder of the untold misery and horror, and was created to remember the victims of this inconceivable catastrophe of the 20th century. It now hangs in the Parliament building. As to the Japanese, in 2014, a ceremony was held at the National War Memorial to honour 17 New Zealand Coast Watchers who had been beheaded by the Japanese during the Second World War. At the same time, Massey University was hosting a Japanese ceramics exhibition in the Old Dominion Museum behind the National War Memorial. Signs advertising the exhibition were attached to lampposts on the road adjacent to the memorial, and we asked the university to remove them on the day of the ceremony, which they did. The Australian Memorial. The Australian Memorial was the first memorial in the park. I mean, this says quite a bit about our approach to memorialisation conflicts. It's like Australia and New Zealand and the rest. My view is that's a slightly naive approach by New Zealand, because many Australians would not hold a similar view. It consists of 15 rugged red sandstone memorials representing the heart of Australia. The red centre symbolised by Uluru Ayers Rock. Each column stands on a band of the same red stone between bands of grey stone symbolising the New Zealand landscape. Inscribed in the black granite insets of seven columns are the names of the theatres and operations in which Australians and New Zealanders served alongside each other. The central column is inscribed with the word Anzac. Ironically, the sandstone comes not from Australia, but from India, because it was a matter of getting it there assuredly on time. I went to the initial planning meeting for this memorial in Canberra, and the message given by the New Zealand side to the Australian side was that there was no way this memorial was to be dominant over our national war memorial. Originally it had more than 15 columns, and the original aim was that on the columns wouldn't just be the war stuff, there would be scores of rugby matches and cricket matches. And no, because as I said, it's about the relationship between the countries. That's what this is supposed to be about. They're not supposed to be war memorials. But this is what they've ended up, in essence, being. Now, I've got two stories to tell about the war memorial, if you forgive me. Down on the bottom left, a photograph of the opening, the Australian Prime Minister and New Zealand's Prime Minister. I welcomed them as they arrived at the site for the opening, and I had a brain block and took them straight to their seats past the joint Australian-New Zealand guard, which was standing there to present arms. As they were about to sit down, I just heard out of the corner of my ear someone shout out, "Guard, ha!" And I realised that there was something that needed to happen. So I was able to say to the two Prime Ministers, "Sirs, the guard is now ready to give you a salute." The second story is I was taking Prince Harry visited the park, and as part of the program, he was to visit the Australian Memorial. So the Australian High Commissioner and I were walking towards the memorial, and it was quite late in the day, and the sun was just starting to sort of move below the hills to the west, and I could see the prince looking at the memorial and looking at the sun. And I started thinking, yeah, he must be sort of thinking there's some relationship. So he said to the Australian High Commissioner, "Is there a relationship between the memorial design and the sun's passage through the sky?" And before the Australian High Commissioner could answer, I said to the prince, "This is an Australian memorial to the Royal Highness." Anyway, so that's the Australian Memorial. And as I said, you know, the space between the Australian Memorial and the National War Memorial is called Anzac Square. The UK Memorial. So this memorial was opened on in July 2017. It represents the trunks of a royal oak and a pahutukawa intertwined to form one single leafy canopy, where leaves from both trees emerge to create a sense of shelter. Standing at the plaque here, a silhouette of a single soldier can be seen, representing the union of two countries who stood side by side in two world wars, and those millions who served in times of conflict, resolution and peace. Now again, a personal view of mine is that given the purpose of these memorials, that silhouette should have been of a person, not of a soldier. Because it's not supposed to be a war memorial. It's about the relationship between the countries. But anyway, it looks very nice. The Pacific Islands Memorial. This memorial represents New Zealand's enduring friendship with the Pacific Islands and the service of Pacific Islanders in support of New Zealand in two world wars and later conflicts. The design depicts a bronze conch shell, which has a patina finish with remembrance poppies, and it recalls the conch shell left in the Aras tunnels by Kuku Airani Cook Island soldiers of New Zealand Tunnelling Company, who were stationed beneath the town during 1916 and 1918. Now, I have a problem with this memorial from a number of angles. So New Zealand loudly promotes its status as a Pacific country. It promotes the fact that we have an intimate and unique relationship with the smaller countries of the Pacific. And yet this memorial, out on the eastern margin of the park, was unveiled 6 years after the Australian Memorial and was the eighth international memorial to be opened, unveiled at Petiari National Memorial Park. And Pacific Island soldiers fought with the 1st Expeditionary Force in World War I. And the other thing I'd like to just demonstrate is look at the scale of the Australian Memorial and the Pacific Islanders Memorial. And we have a unique relationship with the Pacific, so we say. I think it's shocking, really. Anyway. Some final reflections. Memorialisation is the process of remembering the past in a public way and in a particular context. In the case of our military heritage in Apikiahu, it's about remembering our wars and conflicts overseas and those New Zealanders who served in them and those who were killed in them. At the centre of war memorialisation in New Zealand is the Ode of Remembrance, the words of which are specifically addressed by those who were left. We talk about those who shall not grow old as we who are left grow old. And yet many more New Zealanders came home, were wearied by age, and some of them were indeed condemned by the years. Each year the veterans of the wars commemorated in the National War Memorial become fewer. The Anzac Day Dawn Service sees only a few veterans on parade, and at the Korean, Malaya, Malaysian and Vietnam commemorative ceremonies, just a small number of veterans turn up. And there are no discrete ceremonies to acknowledge the multitude of overseas deployments since Vietnam. The future may well be that the National War Memorial and the park will become the venue for wreath-laying ceremonies with the sole function of ticking the government's "We will remember them" box. Now, put this, I really sort of am almost obsessive about this, you know, those who died and those who served thing. And it really crystallised for me when I went to the funeral of a friend who died of a heart attack at the age 72. And in the church service, someone stood up and looked at his body and said, "They shall not grow old as those who are left grow old." Well, actually, it was irrelevant, because he had grown old. So I have this little ode. I call Ode to Those Who Served, and it reads, "Their service was straight and true, and it was for me and you. Their time on land, in the air, and on the rolling wave did not condemn them to a foreign field or unknown grave. History does not record their names in the fallen ranks, but still they are owed the nation's thanks. We will remember them."
On that note, thanks very much. Questions?
Yes. Sir, I may have missed it, but that Odin wrote read out then. Who wrote that?
Neither.
I did, yeah, just in a moment of frustration. I just find it really sad that people who have served, come back, lived a full life, at their funerals, are subjected to the oath of remembrance.
And not changing the subject, but a couple of years back, McWilliam was subjected to earthquake challenges. In the, is that, how's that stand at the moment?
So at the moment, they're going to do work, but they're opening it for ceremonies. So the Merchant Navy Day ceremony was inside the Hall of Memories. And the next one is 16th September, Malaya, is going to be inside the Carol. So I think the work is just going to be on strengthening the belt. But we've created a situation in this country, where would we expect any engineer to say buildings are an earthquake risk? So, but anyway, it is being used for ceremony.
Any other questions? I think that was, you know, really great to get that perspective on our National War Memorial, and it's something that, you know, we have our ceremonies and our services throughout the year, Anzac Day, Armistice Day and the like, but I think certainly, you know, David's comments are worth remembering, that we do stand at the cenotaph each year, a couple of times a year, and have those ceremonies. And apologies for the slight technical hitch, but we solved that problem. And what we'll do is make sure that the PowerPoint presentation, along with the audio recording, will be up on the website, and David's kindly provided the script as well, so we'll put that up so that if you want to revisit it, or if you've missed it, or if you want to have a go again and look at the sync between the script and the images. Again, thanks to our speaker, to Stuart, who records our sessions, and we upload those as well to the Palmerston City Library, with whom we co-host these sessions. Our next session is on the 12th of October. Next month is New Zealand Land Wars. I'll combine the two. Land Wars Month. And Peter Wood is coming back to talk to us about Te Kuti's War, or wars during the period 1868 through 1872, to commemorate the Land Wars. At the moment, we're preparing for Armistice Day, and I can assure you that there will be a service on Saturday, the 11th of November, at 11 o'clock, preferably at the cenotaph, but if the weather kills us again, we may have to go indoors. And then in the evening, we've got a very interesting presentation by the official RNZ RSA historian, who's honorary captain in the Navy, Dr. Andrew MacDonald, who wrote a book a few years ago on Passchendaele, on the Battle for Passchendaele, and that's going to be the title of his presentation coming up on Armistice Day. I can also tell you that the 2024 program is pretty much full, and we'll put that out in draft form, because they are dynamic programs, if you like. But we, next year, we're going to cover a lot of anniversaries, because 2024... comprises many significant anniversaries of a lot of activity that went on both here in New Zealand and overseas during that time. So once again, thanks very much. Thank you for your donations, which will be gratefully received by the Charitable Trust. And again, if you could just join us in thanking our speaker.